Promise made, promise kept. You gotta say it, the tax bill is basically a done deal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 20th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. They liked it so much, they voted for it twice. Not my line about the GOP's tax bill, but it fits. After a procedural hiccup yesterday, both the House and Senate have now passed the thing. Wall Street, interestingly, stocks specifically, seem largely bored by taxes the past couple of days. No big gains, but that's okay, because I want to steer you away from stocks toward the bond market and what the tax bill is doing there, where the interest rates on government debt, bonds specifically, are going up. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath gets us going.
Selling bonds is how government borrows money. But don't take it from me. Take it from Bugs Bunny, dressed up as Uncle Sam in a World War II cartoon.
Any bonds today? Bonds of freedom, that's what I'm selling. Any bonds today?
Come on and get them, folks. Come on, skip right up and get them.
A huge number of people buy bonds.
Mike Schumacher at Wells Fargo Securities.
Individual investors like you or me, big financial institutions, and also many investors overseas.
When you buy a U.S. Treasury bond, you're lending money to the government. Enter the national debt. Altogether now, how much is the tax bill going to increase it?
The tax bill is going to add about $1 trillion to our debt at the end of 10 years.
And that's the low estimate, says Bill Klein,
senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
In order to borrow that extra trillion, Klein says, the U.S. will have to sell a lot more bonds.
Right. When the government has more debt, it has to borrow more from the market, so it's competing with the private sector to borrow, and the competition drives up the interest rate.
And the anticipation of that is one reason why, as Kyle will tell you in a few minutes, the yield on the 10-year T-note moved dramatically this week. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Yes, I will. But first, one doesn't often hear about bribery cases on the order of $1 billion. But we have got one of those for you today. An Italian judge has ruled that two multinational oil companies and their executives are going to go to trial in a case that is complicated, but at its core alleges that Shell and the Italian oil giant Eni paid more than $1 billion for drilling rights in Nigeria that were, in fact, bribes. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from the Sustainability Desk, the case has the firm attention of American bankers and oil executives.
The case alleges that executives at Shell and Eni, also known as Eni, knew company payments to Nigeria were bribes to officials and the president. Leaked emails from Shell mention, quote, paying people off, and a minister, quote, on the take. To Barnaby Pace at the anti-corruption group Global Witness in London, oil executives in the U.S. and elsewhere should pay heed.
We think this is a watershed moment for the oil industry where oil executives should start getting very worried that if they continue to see bribery as a way to do business, they could find themselves seeing serious jail term.
It's unusual for a case like this to go to trial rather than being settled. It will shine light on the murky world of international oil deals, says compliance lawyer Tom Fox. He spent his career in the Houston energy business.
Companies don't want this type of information getting out, and they don't want the reputational damage. Even if they are able to get a defensive verdict, certainly they're not going to look good in the light of day, in the light of transparency.
The controversy has brought a separate suit against the U.S. bank J.P. Morgan, accused of negligence in transferring money to Nigeria. The bank and the oil companies and executives have denied wrongdoing. For Nigeria, the upshot is $1 billion went missing. That's equal to the country's annual health budget and could have gone to, say, vaccines, says Edwin Ikoria of the nonprofit One Campaign in Nigeria.
You can just do the math and see the number of kids' lives that could have been saved if only the government had access to more resources.
The trial starts in March. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, bonds, people, bonds. But we are going to do stocks for you as well when we do the numbers. There's a story in the New York Times that's getting a well-deserved amount of buzz. An investigation into two Chicago-area Ford Motor Company factories rife with sexual assault and mistreatment in a workplace culture that has lasted for decades. Susan Chira and her colleague Katrin Einhorn reported the story, which you do need to know, the recounting of which might not be appropriate for everybody who is nearby. Susan Chira, welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here.
Tell you what, there is so much in this piece to unpack. I want to start with the thing that jumped out at me first. It's all horrific, but more to the point, I guess. This is the first one of these stories or investigations we've seen that have been almost entirely blue-collar workers and specifically women of color.
That's right. That was very much the intent. A lot of us at the Times have been discussing how to expand our coverage of sexual harassment, and months ago, we knew we wanted to focus on blue-collar women because much of the reporting had looked at women in white-collar workplaces.
Yeah. The great thing about this piece, just from a radio reporter perspective, is that you have sound. You have the voices of these women. I want to play one now and talk about it. Her name is Tanya Exum, and here's something that she told you in the Times.
There were instances where he would come up and smack me on my bottom. The day that really sent me over the edge. I was loading a robot, and he walked into the same cell that I'm in and grabs my behind. I turned around to him, and I said, "Keep your hands to yourself. As I've told you plenty of times before, I'm not interested."
So I'll tell you, that was one of the milder pieces of tape in this piece, as you know.
Indeed.
Yeah. You and your colleagues wrote this about the environment in these Chicago plants. Sex, swagger, suspicion, and racial resentment were pervasive. Give us a sense of what it was like out there for these women.
What the environment was like is that these women entered factories where men had always been in charge. They were in the minority, both in terms of being women and in terms of being African American, although gradually the African American population at the Chicago Assembly Plant swelled. But they were entering a man's world, a world where there was a lot of sexual entitlement. The power was held largely by men who could wield it to get sexual favors or threaten punishment, either by assigning them to physically demanding jobs that were grueling and could cause injury, or by excusing latenesses or other issues where they were sort of had them over a barrel.
Yeah. These women, though, were in theory protected by really strong union membership, the United Auto Workers. Here's Terry Lewis Bledsoe talking about that.
The union, they really didn't want us to call the hotline. It was going to close the plant. And then the union also told me, "Terry, if I was you, you need to stop complaining this much. Stop going to labor relations because you're going to make a name for yourself." And I said, "What is that? You're going to be called a troublemaker." "Then a troublemaker I shall be."
It's a lose-lose deal for these women.
Yes, that's the thing that Katrin and I discovered. All the people who were supposed to protect them failed them. Now, union and co-workers were very, very concerned that making trouble could close the plant. Remember, the auto industry hovered on the brink of bankruptcy only in 07, 08, 09. So this was a very strong memory. And then the union, you know, overall, their first priority was protecting jobs. Right. It's not to say that there weren't people who really helped these women, because there were, but they were not in the majority.
Ford says it takes all investigations and claims seriously, but a lot of these harassers, accused or otherwise, still on the job years later.
That's right. I have no doubt, and our interviews with Ford suggested that there were a lot of sincere efforts to curb the harassment over the years. But what we learned is that in an environment like this, where even culturally in our society, there's still so much pervasive harassment, you can never take your eye off the ball. And there are a lot of things you have to do. And one of them is you have to make it clear that harassment can cost you your job. And so if workers see that men known to be harassers at the plant are still there, they think anyone can get away with it.
Susan Chira, along with her colleague Katrin Einhorn at the New York Times, in a piece that I can't recommend strongly enough about harassment at the blue-collar worker level, specifically of women of color. It's amazing. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Cable television companies have a problem, and it's not going away. They're trying to hang on to their customers as more and more of them drift over to the likes of Hulu and Netflix, which is why those cable companies are cracking down on password sharing and, they hope, the bleeding off of tens of millions of dollars in lost revenue. The CEO of Charter Communications, we read in Bloomberg today, says he is willing to lead the password charge. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
When Lubna Hindi wanted to watch Orange is the New Black on Netflix, she just hit up a friend and asked for her login.
I still use that person's password, and it's been like almost 5 years.
Now, an HBO password, that is more coveted, she says. She had to ask four people. And when friends and family want to use her cable subscription?
Sure, you can have it.
No problem. But for pay TV operators, it is a big problem, says analyst Britt Sappington of Park Associates. Just this year, it cost them $3.5 billion in subscriptions, or about 3% of overall market revenue.
It's not landscape changing, but at the same time, 3%, that's a pretty big number.
Sappington says in total, about 16% of adults in U.S. households admit they share passwords for a video service. And
those that are the most likely to share passwords are those that never subscribe to pay TV ever.
So how do TV providers plan to clamp down on the practice while grabbing new customers? Himish Bisay heads up Cinecore, which manages streaming service logins. He says they could allow less simultaneous streaming or require a password more often, but crack down too much?
You just raise consumer ire.
Bisay says his college son uses his login.
We don't want to do things that make natural use cases like that, where members of the household have trouble accessing content that has been paid for.
One solution, he says, is to educate so people know that swapping passwords is a form of piracy. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's going to be a new start, a new chapter, and I'm going to go for it. You know, it'll be all okay, you know.
Fingers crossed, man. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so we're going to do this a little bit backwards today. As we mentioned earlier, keep an eye on bonds. Today, bond prices fell. That means the yield goes up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to a 9-month high today, 2.49%. That's up from about 2.35 a week or so ago. Not much when you look at the really long-term chart, but relatively speaking, in that space of time, it's a big move. Talked about bribery in Italy earlier involving two oil giants and bribery allegations. Royal Dutch Shell sputtered 0.2% today. The Italian firm Eni off about 0.5%. The market is sorting out the tax bill winners and losers. Real estate could take a hit with changes to the mortgage interest deduction on new loans, big new loans, among other things. Online real estate database Zillow clicked down 0.3% today. International art and real estate broker Sotheby's trickled down about 0.1% today as well. Bonds, well, I already did those. You're listening to Marketplace. When it comes to news about the economy, Marketplace has got you covered. And when you donate $10 a month or more to support the work we do, you can get a Marketplace umbrella to help protect you from stormy weather. The real benefit of giving comes when you listen every day, knowing that you're making it possible for Marketplace to help people understand the economy and the financial forces that govern our lives. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do more of it and reach more people as well. Become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was more news this morning about strength in residential real estate. The National Association of Realtors, which, yes, has vested interest in these numbers being good, they reported the number of existing home sales rose last month, growing at the fastest rate in more than 10 years. Handy for us, then, that our corner office interview today is the guy who runs a company that a lot of homeowners patronize. Craig Menear is the CEO of the Home Depot. Mr. Menear, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
When you walk into one of your stores, what do you see? I mean, as you walk in there as the guy running the place, what are you looking for? What do you see?
Really two things. Looking for product, and is product presented as the hero, if you will, in the business. And then looking always for our associates, to connect with our associates.
What does it mean for the product to be the hero? That is, I've interviewed a gazillion CEOs and not one has ever said that.
Well, in the retail business, the reason customers come to us is to buy product. So, you know, product helps solve problems in our business. Product helps to create, aspirational dreams in our business. And so is the product presented in such a way that creates excitement for the customer and, you know, likewise, candidly, for our associates, because we want to get them fired up to sell it.
Okay, so when I go into a Home Depot, and maybe this is just me, but I'll bet you it's no small portion of your shoppers, it's not dreams we're looking for, man. It's that 3x5 piece of plywood that we can fit in the back of the van to fix the thing we need. So how do you, you know where I'm going, right? So how do you translate the, the mundane and rudimentary into, and I get it what you're saying, dreams, right? But how do you do that?
Well, there's lots of different customers that we serve in our business. Obviously, the customer who's coming in looking for that piece of plywood to fix that problem. But then we also have the customers coming in to transform a room, and they're looking for a new paint color. They're looking for the latest in flooring that will transform how their bedroom looks or how their living room looks. And that's what I'm talking about when we help the customer create new dreams in their home.
What is your I guess worst nightmare, right? But what's the thing that keeps you up at night?
Actually, the thing that keeps me up right now is the amount of change that's happening in our business and being able to continue to make the change that we need to have happen to stay ahead of where the customer is taking us and be able to continue to execute at the level we've been executing at.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned change because I was doing some research, obviously, before we sat down. Home Depot is like the fourth largest e-commerce vendor out there, right? You guys do billions and billions of dollars online, which it doesn't seem like, you know, plywood online would be a thing.
No,
I know you guys sell more than plywood. I'm using that as a good example.
No, we do. We have a large e-commerce business that candidly is connected to our physical stores. It's what we call interconnected retail. The front door of our store is no longer at the front door of our store. It's truly in the customer's pocket. It's on the job site. It's on, you know, when they're sitting on their couch. The shopping experience in most categories starts in the digital world, even if it finishes in the physical world now.
How sensitive are you to fluctuations in the economy? I mean, if consumers aren't feeling, you know, hopeful about things, they're not going to redo their bathrooms.
Sure. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, when we think about our business, we start with GDP as the foundation. And then for us, we layer in on top the tailwind that we've had from housing for the past several years. Yeah. And that gives us a foundational base for what we think is going to happen in the business. And then all growth above those two things are really what we're taking in terms of share.
So how you feeling now with the tax bill happening and the economy, you know, reasonably strong?
So we feel good about the environment. We're very fortunate. The customer's willing to spend in our space. We've been, give or take, 200 basis points of comp generated from the tailwind in housing. That's really been around household formation.
In layman's terms, it's 2%, right?
Yeah, 2%, yes. Right. Thank you. So 2% growth really from household formation, home values. And if you think about home values, when home values are increasing, customers feel good about investing in their home.
Yeah.
When the downturn happened in, you know, 2000, late 2007, 2008, home values were declining. And so that kitchen countertop was no longer considered an investment. It became an expense and they stopped doing it.
You're looking at a big cut in the corporate tax rate. What are you going to do with that money?
Well, we just announced that we're basically doubling the investment in our business to roughly over $11 billion in the next 3 years to continue to make sure that we're relevant for our customers, that we're driving to this interconnected retail space that we think wins in the long run. And so that will be certainly, you know, spent in the business driving that kind of investment.
Who's your competition? Lowe's, I imagine, and who else?
Our competition is multiple players. We compete against, you know, home improvement retailers. We compete against, you know, building material suppliers. We compete against digital competitors. So we have over 220 categories of goods that we sell in our stores, and there are different competitors in each of those categories.
You know, it's funny. So 220 categories, each of which have probably, it seems to me every time I go in that store, like 1,000 items in them, right? So there's more product there that you can shake a stick at.
We carry on average about 30,000 to 35,000 stocked items in a store.
And I feel every one of them. Craig Menear, he's the CEO of the Home Depot. Mr. Menear, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Home Depot, as it happens, is one of the companies that's announced big stock buybacks the past couple of weeks in the run-up to the corporate tax cut that is about to befall them. I asked Craig Menear about that and what he's doing. You can hear his answer on our Corner Office podcast. Here's the thing demographers and businesses alike are starting to worry about. The idea that over the next couple of decades, millions of baby boomers are going to leave the workforce. It's going to be a problem everywhere, but it's going to be a problem in Maine first, where the median age, half the people are older, half are younger, is almost 45, the oldest in the country. The worry, of course, is that there aren't going to be enough young workers to replace the boomers who are retiring. But Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg reports the state is trying to rethink its college system to fill that gap.
Yeah, five grams.
Freshman Philip Parent tinkers with metal weights in an introductory physics class at the University of Maine at Machias. Parent has known for years that he wants to be an engineer, ever since he was a teenager when he visited his dad's workplace, a giant airplane hangar.
It was life-changing because, like, if you want to aspire to be an engineer and you see all these functions, you're like, oh, what does this do?
Last year, Parent actually had his sights set on another school, almost 100 miles away in Orono. That's where the engineering program is located for Maine's flagship university. Parent got in, but with a catch. The school told him that the engineering program had already filled up.
I was kind of full of anger for a split second, you know. I was like, you know, why me? Why did I, out of all the people, get pushed back?
Parent looked at online classes, even thought about leaving the state. But a month later, a school counselor called and presented him with another offer. Through a new partnership, Parent could take his first year of classes in Machias, then transfer to Orono to finish his degree. He was relieved.
It's going to be a new start, a new chapter, and I'm going to go for it. You know, it'll be all okay, you know.
This new path is part of a bigger initiative by Maine's entire university system. Traditionally, the state's seven public campuses have been pretty independent from each other. But System Chancellor James Page says that with a giant workforce shortage on the horizon, that needed to change.
And be, I think, more responsive to the economic and demographic slash social challenges that the state was facing.
The idea is that by combining resources, the system could help train more people for jobs, especially those in demand, like cybersecurity or nursing. Page says the new system offers courses to more students that are closer to where some of them live, even in rural northern Maine.
They can do more seamless transfer. They could start here and go there. All of those pieces that are open.
There are some positive signs already. Enrollment in some of the state's universities has started to grow after years of decline. However, almost all of that growth for undergraduates is still coming from out of state, not from students within Maine. John Doerr, a consultant for the Maine Community College System, says there's still work to be done to get older students into the system, especially those who may have lost their jobs in recent years.
These are folks who need lots of help with bringing their basic skill levels up and their technical skills to fit what the labor market is looking for.
All told, Maine has its work cut out for it over the next decade if it wants to keep its businesses happy. The state's Department of Labor estimates that by 2027, Maine will need to recruit up to 5,000 workers per year to replace retiring baby boomers. In Machias, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a press release from AT&T just as President Trump was starting his celebratory remarks at the White House this afternoon.
And I noticed this just came out 2 minutes ago. They handed it to me. AT&T plans to increase U.S. capital spending $1 billion and provide $1,000 special bonus to more than 200,000 U.S. employees, and that's because of what we did. So that's pretty good.
It is pretty good. $1 billion on capital expenditures is real money, don't get me wrong, and a one-time $1,000 bonus is nice. Not as good as permanent wage increases, but nice. AT&T did specifically credit the GOP tax bill for making that happen. One is obliged to mention here, just for context, that AT&T does have a giant and not uncontroversial merger pending before the Trump administration. All right, we're done. The Dow off 28 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ and the S&P basically unchanged. The 10-year Treasury note, just to be continuous here, 2.49%. That yield is up. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.